Hi, this is Aliza Licht, and this is Leave Your Mark, the podcast, where I brew fresh career advice with some of my most inspiring and successful friends. It's professional advice that you can action immediately, whether you're just starting out in your career or well on your way. With a massive to-do list and a large cup of coffee, I promise that you can get it all done and still have time to post about it. I am so honored and excited to have Marissa Meltzer here today on Leave Your Mark. Marissa needs no introduction. She is a renowned journalist based in New York who for over a decade has covered beauty, fashion, wellness, and celebrity industries for top national publications like the New York Times, The New Yorker, Guardian, Wall Street Journal, Vogue, Vanity Fair, the list goes on. She's also an author of three previous books. This is Big, How Sassy Changed My Life, and Girl Power. And now her best-selling book, Glossy, has made huge waves. Marissa, welcome to Leave Your Mark. I am thrilled to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you. It's such a great introduction. Thank you. So happy to be here.
Oh my God, you're so welcome. Well, I will say that was my professional podcast introduction, but since my own book is about personal branding, right, on brand, I noticed your bio on your website is very sassy. I loved it. So I'm going to read what you say about yourself on your website, which is, I'm a writer based in New York City. My latest book, Glossy, the inside story of Emily Weiss's Glossier, is out now. I write for the New York Times, New Yorker, The Guardian, Vanity Fair, New York Magazine, and Vogue, among many other places. My goal is to be more like my bulldog, Joan, who sleeps 22 hours a day. So I started teaching restorative yoga classes. Come and take one with me at Sky Ting. I love that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. You approve as a professional branding.
Well, you know what I love about it? It really gives us an insight into like your persona, you know, because obviously the professional bio is super impressive, but like we just get a glimpse into like what's important to you. And I don't believe that you would sleep 22 hours a day, to be clear. So
no, but I like the idea of having that level of relaxation and carefree that you could sleep. I've been an insomniac my whole life. So anyone that is a peaceful sleeper, I just am in awe of. I feel like my life would be so different if I didn't struggle with sleep.
Oh God, that is so hard. Well, aside from all your amazing work, which does take up time during the day, I'd love to hear a little bit about your background and where you're from and where you grew up and if what you're doing now and what you've accomplished has always been a lifelong dream.
I grew up in California. I just actually got back yesterday. I was visiting my family. I grew up in Santa Cruz, which is maybe like an hour and 15 minutes away from San Francisco. I did not like growing up there. It's kind of like an outdoorsy hippie town. And I was always, you know, wanted to live in a big city. And I just was like reading books in a corner while other people wanted to go hiking and surf and stuff like that. And I was always really good at writing, but I didn't have very like specific or highly formed views on what I wanted to do. I was very taken with the magazine world and publishing just because I read a lot of magazines growing up and read a lot of books, but I sort of just found my way into it.
So you have covered obviously fashion, beauty, wellness. I mean, that's your beat. And this endeavor to really almost institutionalize the story from a historical perspective for Emily Weiss and Glossier, I think we need to go back a little bit to the girl boss era of just understanding like what your perspective was in the beginning of that, because we all sort of watched that all happen. Mm-hmm. Were you tracking this story that whole time too? Like, was it piquing your interest back then too?
Oh, for sure. I was tracking it, not so much because I thought I would write a book on it, although I was always writing about Emily Weiss and Glossier and all of those women and those brands were kind of in the orbit of things that I wrote about. So I was keeping an eye on them, but there was also kind of a sense of fatigue that I had even then that I didn't want to read yet another story about them because it felt like they were everywhere. But they were definitely on my radar. And it's interesting because that era, it feels so long ago and like it's already ripe for kind of criticism and discussion and looking back at it. So I think part of it was the pandemic, and no one is, really has those jobs, or those companies are very different, that it felt like recent history that could be explored. And it's always a thrill for me that people agree that they also want to talk about it because, you do run the risk of people sort of still having a little bit of fatigue around subjects. You never know if you're going to write about something that just lands with a thud.
Yeah, for
So
sure.
speak. Yeah.
But like, why Emily Weiss versus Sophia Amoruso, for example? I mean, there's plenty of candidates that you could have been like, okay, you know what? I'm going to take that business. Like, why Glossier?
Well, I think because I had written about beauty so much, and I had written about Glossier much more than I had written about almost anything else. So I had the contacts, and I also had context. I had been following the company and interviewing Emily for a number of years. So there was that. And then just on a more practical level, one of the last things I had done before the pandemic was a big profile of Glossier for Vanity Fair. And so then in lockdown, it was still just very fresh on my mind. And meanwhile, we're on Zooms. I am looking at myself in the mirror all day and thinking about how beauty really felt like it was surpassing fashion in terms of just cultural capital. And these were things that I had been thinking about a lot in recent years, with just the rise of companies like Glossier that were, becoming huge in the beauty industry and the kind of decentralization. And I thought that there was space to do a book about the power of the beauty industry. And Glossier would always be, I don't know, kind of a through line or one of the central stories. So my way into it was more that this was going to be a book about the beauty industry with a focus on Glossier. And as I started writing, researching, it became clear that it was the opposite. It was a book about a Glossier that could touch on everything else that I was obsessed with.
I'm not surprised because even when you read about Emily in her intern days, right? It's like
Oh, yeah.
she is already a character. So I'm sure as you started to have all these interviews, it became very clear that there was so much meat to the story.
And
And
branding, right?
I,
Like
for sure, for
positioning
sure.
yourself. I mean, that's really what beauty is essentially, because so many of the formulas are the same. People are rarely buying things because it's a groundbreaking formula or something like that. It's all about the way it's sold to us.
Do you think Glossier would have ended up where it is if Instagram didn't exist?
No, probably not. I mean, it does quite well on TikTok, so potentially it could have done well with a different supporting social media platform. But I think part of, the key to their rise was they did come out kind of right around the time that Instagram was solidifying. They came out in 2014, and that's the year that I finally joined Instagram. And I feel like I was one of the last people in my friend group to do so. And, the way that Glossier launched was actually on Instagram, which was kind of unheard of. They were the first brand to really do so. And now it's so commonplace. Like, you're teasing images and everything. But, when they did it, it was like, ooh, what is this? What are they coming out with? And then they really helped kind of define the aesthetic of Instagram with that light Glossier pink that they use, the dewy selfies, the models who were, real women or kind of more like real women than like a supermodel. And yeah, I think those things help propel each other. And also, there weren't nearly as many brands on Instagram, and following them was sort of intriguing rather than annoying or something like that. So I think they just got like a huge bump of early followers too.
It's so funny whenever, a brand really takes ownership of a color. It's almost like the color didn't exist before. Like pink
Yeah.
didn't exist before Glossier, and obviously we know pink did. And the other idea that you really drive home is this idea of brand as best friend. Now, Emily herself as a person doesn't seem like a warm, fuzzy girl best friend. Where did that stem from? That sort of like, this is your best girlfriend, this makeup. It's like you're talking to your friend. Like, where do you think? Because I don't feel, I mean, I don't know her, but from what I gather from her, she doesn't feel very approachable in that way.
Yeah, in fact, it was a real pivot because her early fame was on the Hills as a super intern, you know, this very sort of wearing all dark colors, New York City intern who could pronounce chinoiserie and, you know, knew the names of all the flowers. And when she launched Glossier, there was this pivot, and I would think it was just an extremely manufactured idea to brand the company, literally saying, you can sit with us, and smiley faces, and, you know, you but better. It was very sunny, very friendly. And that's not who she was, which is not to say that she was some kind of dragon lady type, because, you know, we hate those sorts of scenarios where women have to be one or the other, but she's a cipher. I mean, there's a reason why the book is so compelling, is because she's a fascinating and complicated woman who doesn't adhere to every sort of stereotype about what being a female leader is or isn't. And I think part of that is, you know, the brand wasn't called Emily Weiss. It was called Glossier. It was supposed to be its own thing. So it didn't have to necessarily mirror Emily. And I think the fewer people that associated Glossier directly with its founder, probably the better, in terms of that meant that it would had a bigger saturation on the market, you know, that it was less sort of tied to kind of beauty insiders. But it's an interesting dance, and you could see it play out as she did publicity and as her fame rose. And I think that's where you get some of that girl boss stuff, where it's like, I'm a hard worker, but I'm approachable, but I'm also just like you, but I'm also different from, you know, all of these sorts of mixed messages of that era.
Totally. But you know, it's so interesting. It's like, normally when a founder creates something from scratch, right, you would think some of their core values would be infused into the foundational, you know, bricks of the company. And it seems like she seems like a totally different person from like the sort of mantra of you can sit with us and sunny kind of lovely company. I think she just seems more calculated.
I agree. I think that she probably thinks of herself differently than that. I don't know that she thinks of herself as an every woman, but I do think she thinks of herself as a little more like, oh, I'm, you know, messy and normal and I make mistakes. And I don't know that the way that she sees herself is the way that everyone else seems to see her, at least in the press, how she's portrayed. And that tension is interesting, for sure. I think that she probably sees her values and aesthetic reflected in Glossier in terms of, she is not a, you know, Kardashian contoured makeup kind of woman. She is very much like the Glossier aesthetic of just, you know, give me an easy lip to wear, give me a nice, you know, cream blush, some products that I could throw on easily to look a little bit more put together, you know, if I want it.
Which only work on a 20-something year old, right? So it's like, I'm sorry, like I will never
forget.
Do you
think so?
Well, I do. I'll never forget. So I also, you know, grew up in fashion magazines, and one of the things on my wall back in the day of my room that literally was wallpapered in magazines, it was a quote that said, natural beauty is rarely achieved naturally. And I think that a lot of the stuff is very sheer, and you're working from a place of like perfect skin, right? And it's like, most people can't just like throw on like a light clear lip or like a dewy sheer foundation and feel good. I'm like, how thick can I make it so it covers, you know, my scars?
Yeah, see, I'm the opposite. Whether or not I look better with a lot of makeup, I just can't deal with the feeling. It feels like
It's
I
so
have to
funny.
wash it off immediately. But for me, the artifice is in other ways. It's with hair, or it's with, the amount of time I spend exercising or dieting or getting my clothes tailored, or the fact that I'm wearing, sheer foundation because I get a facial once a month and I have gotten laser treatments to have my skin, clear and whatever. So I think you're totally right. But I also think that maybe they're speaking to something too that's a little bit like you don't have to choose, that you can one day you might want a full face of makeup and for other times you don't. And it kind of feels like a little outdated or like something from like an 80s magazine that we probably grew up reading, where it's like you can be this kind of girl or this kind of girl, but you have to choose. And really, we're all probably both, just depending on our mood and what we're doing and, the day.
Yeah. So you're walking in the street downtown tomorrow and you bump into Emily. What happens?
I don't know, actually. For the first time, someone was throwing a party for someone and invited me, and I think quite sincerely inquired, if I could be in the same room with her because she was also invited. And I wasn't able to find out because I don't think she went, and I was also out of town and wasn't able to go. I'm not gonna lie, I think I would feel a little bit awkward or sheepish because the last few times we spoke, she was, crying and had a lot of ambivalence about the book. And I have reached out kind of through official channels for any sort of statement that I have not gotten. So yeah, I think it would be weird, but I mean, I stand by the book, and I think if anything, it's given the company a certain gravitas. It's given them probably some eyes that had never heard of Glossier before. There's certainly a serious business and tech readership that has really championed the book that, are not people that were necessarily buying like Milky Jelly cleanser. And also, we're in a place where people don't love critical thought. And I think the book is such a good example of how to be critical of something is true meaning of, picking it apart for the good, the bad, being incredibly nuanced. And that is what women leaders and all business leaders deserve, right? Is someone to really take them seriously. So, but yeah, I'm not a sadist. I don't like making people uncomfortable. I don't particularly like confrontation. I don't think she would have it. I think we would probably say an awkward hello and probably stick to our own sides of the room, if I'm being honest.
Of course, you're being honest. I think one of the things that you have been complimented for is your fair and sharp analysis of the business, the good, the bad, the indifferent, right? And I think that when you build something that big, you need to be comfortable with the analysis because otherwise, what's the example for anyone to learn from, right? So I'm sure when she first learned about this book, she was probably like, how do I kill this story, right? Like, how do I kill this? But
I do have to say, no one offered me any kind of money to start with me. So I don't know if she did.
was
She didn't try that hard.
a mistake. Okay, so your process, obviously, you're like really an expert at your reporting and your sources and figuring out who you need to speak to, and you've done this a million times. But when you were writing the book in the beginning, were you thinking about a possible adaptation? Because now we know that Amazon is going to make this into some fabulous moment for TV, right? They're adapting it for TV. But when you were writing it, was that on your mind of like, what are the ways this can be sort of extrapolated? Or were you just like, let me just make this book as thorough as possible?
I think it's the latter. I was really focused on telling the story in a way that was thrilling and fun. But I mean, I also think, I, like everyone, watch television and movies and grew up in this culture of that kind of storytelling. So, of course, there's cinematic elements that can't be sort of separated from the writing. Like, that's kind of how we view everything. But I'm cynical. I guess we've all, meaning many writers, have had pieces optioned, and it's a little bit like a lottery ticket, whether or not something actually gets made from it. And so I was hoping that it would be optioned, but I also was coming with sort of zero expectations that it would actually get made. Also, I don't have any latent desire to be a screenwriter, really.
Well, I'm gonna just put this on the record on Leave Your Mark right now. I guarantee it's gonna happen because I do, because the story is too good. And also the amount of information you put into this book, like it's endless where somebody who jumps off of that can go from a TV perspective. Who do you think should play her?
Oh my gosh. I've had so many people DMing me with ideas, which is such a total delight and the most fun kind of fantasy casting. I've heard, oh gosh, Allison Williams, I think would be great. Like, also physically, they kind of look alike. Who else have people said? Julia Garner. Mikey Madsen. I think it's such a good part for someone, for the right
Such a good
person,
part. Such a good part.
that, yeah, I'm just really excited to see. You know, I think the first step is finding the right writer with the right take, because there are so many kind of tones that this could be.
I promise Leave Your Mark will be right back after a quick message from our sponsor. Are you ready for more career advice? Welcome back to Leave Your Mark. So, one of the exercises in my book on brand is thinking about yourself professionally in three adjectives. If you had to think of three adjectives to describe Emily professionally, what would you say?
Assertive, ambivalent, indirect.
Okay, I got the assertive one. Explain
I
ambivalent and explain indirect.
think that she could really vacillate in terms of how she felt about things or maybe even people. And I think that was probably one of the issues that Glossier had of, you know, she was really steering the ship. She had final say, and something like spending money, likely millions, on developing a sub brand or a tech, like an app that didn't see the light of the day, you know, that money was spent and that time was devoted because one day, like a lot of other leaders, this is not so specific to her, but it's full force. This is what we're committed to. Another day, it's no longer, you know, focus. And so I think that could be hard too on some employees where they felt, you know, like, I don't know what the focus of my job is this week, and it seems to change a lot. I think indirect, I think it was a little bit of that kind of suffering from wanting to be liked and maybe not being the most natural at being kind of warm and fuzzy, which I relate to. I mean, I'm also not a particularly like soft maternal person. I think I can be a little bit harsh sometimes in my dealings with people and have to kind of like remind myself to, I don't know, soften it up, soften the blows up a little bit. And so I think for her, that could come across as a little like, I'm telling someone else to tell you this, or like, I'm telling you something, but it's not really coming out as the criticism that she thinks it is. And then suddenly you've been warned or you've been fired, and it feels a little like out of nowhere. These are some of the second and third hand accounts that I've heard, were just that people felt a little unclear, or that they weren't necessarily so in the loop that there were going to be layoffs or something, which again is not necessarily Glossier or Emily specific. Companies, you know, lay people off, and not every employee is privy to everything all the time. But I do think that there was a little bit of a feeling of like, what does she want from me? Like, what was that meeting just about? You know?
Right. It's funny though. I mean, I guess because my background is fashion and we're so used to working with creatives who change their mind all the time, who have a point of view, depending on, my favorite thing to do when any new directive came my way, would be like, wait, who was the last meeting with? Like, to try to trace back, like, who changed someone's opinion when it was
Oh,
set,
that's really smart. Yeah.
right? Because it usually
Yeah.
is the last person that they spoke
Yeah.
to.
Reverse engineering. Yeah. That
Yeah.
is really
Yes.
bright. Yeah.
So I just feel like she's pretty typical in that sense. And it really makes me feel like, and I'm sure you would agree, that like she probably should have been replaced a long time ago.
Yes. I mean, I don't want to spoil the book, although it's all sort of, played out publicly, but I do think that the board gave her a long time to be CEO. And I think it wasn't so much one giant thing that
Yeah.
made them ask her to leave, but a lot of smaller missteps, some bigger than others, that finally, was like time. It was time. The
Yeah.
company was growing. And frankly, it isn't uncommon for the founder of a company to step down as it grows and step down as CEO and have someone, a seasoned person with an MBA, which is exactly who they hired.
Yeah.
But I imagine that was probably really hard on everyone. But I agree with you that it probably should have happened sooner.
A lot of the people you spoke to were quite loyal to her, right? But at the same time, I know you mentioned that she had very sort of unique hiring processes or things that she was looking for. What are some of the things that she would look for? What was atypical about the hires she made, the process?
Well, early on when the company was so small and, they probably didn't even have any real hiring processes in place, she had a great knack for, hiring kind of somewhat unconventional people that ended up being stars. She hired Alexis Page away from MAC Cosmetics. And Alexis was a fairly young woman who had worked on all of their like collaborations. And she hired her to be Glossier's first product developer and develop some of the products that are still, some of their best sellers like Boy Brow and Milky Jelly Cleanser and those sorts of things. And she had Annie Kreigbaum, who was a writer, for like websites, who ended up being a total savant at naming products. She named Cloud Paint and Boy Brow. And so Emily had a real knack for hiring people who remain really sought after and powerful today, to the point that like having Glossier on your resume was a real pedigree and almost a detriment for Glossier because people could leave and take really lucrative jobs as consultants or found their own companies or, get hired by a big conglomerate. But then as Glossier got larger and Emily became that kind of last person that you interview with before you get the job offer, she had some quirks. She definitely liked asking people their horoscope signs or astrology signs. She liked to ask people, why do you work? Which I always think is a little bit funny in a dark way, slash a little bit like let them eat cake or something like that. I think that
Yes.
because the answer for pretty much everyone is, it's like asking why I eat or breathe. Like I have no choice. And also, I think that what she was trying to do was to have this kind of like signature deep thinking question, the way that you heard that, like, I think it was Google has some sort of signature logic test or this kind of like tech founder, philosopher kind of role that she was trying to adopt for a while. But like so many things, it landed a little strangely with some of the prospective employees.
You think? Going back to Girl Boss for just a moment, I mean, do you think that she was held to a different standard from other peers that maybe weren't girl bosses?
Yeah, for sure. I think they all were. Part of that is not necessarily their fault, but they were propped up in the public in this way, which helps them. And, it wasn't an accident that they were being written about or portrayed that way. These were all women that had consumer companies and they chose to be very forward-facing leaders. And they had communications teams and publicists who were pitching them. They had stylists that were dressing them a certain way. So it wasn't really an accident, but it also put them on a pedestal and made them kind of an easy target to bring down a little bit. And then once there started being like exposés of some of their work practices or leadership traits, I think there was a little bit of a feeling of blood in the water and people kind of wanting to take them down one by one.
Yeah, then we get into the mean girls genre.
Exactly. I mean, it's all, it's very adolescent in a way, but I understand it.
Yeah. Oh my God. Totally. So you're a super interesting writer because I feel like your perspective on things is very unique. And I go back to a piece you wrote in 2019 about the uninfluencer
Oh,
because
yeah.
I loved it. And I think we live in a time, obviously, when, influence is a currency, right? And just for everyone listening, Marissa's piece was basically about like how sometimes she sees a post but from an influencer and it makes her not like the thing that the influencer is peddling. This is sort of counterintuitive mentality. When you were thinking about your analysis of different subjects. Do you have certain filters that you're just like, okay, that's super interesting, and you're going to file that somewhere in your brain or put it down for a later thing? Like, I just feel like you're very observant of what is happening, and you have your own unique view on the thing that maybe everyone else is thinking one way, and you're like over here about.
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess I'm not so aware of my unique view because, we're all just in our own heads.
Right.
Yeah, I definitely keep my eye on certain things, more just that I'll be obsessed with something. The uninfluencer piece came out of, I think, a joke that a friend of mine made. We were just laughing because it was so true that there were certain people in our lives that would, like tag all their outfits on Instagram or like something that they bought. And even if the thing was like some kitchen gadget that I thought was kind of cool, it instantly made me not want it at all. And that was something that I then, maybe months later mentioned to an editor. And then months after that, she said, "Oh, do you want to finally write this piece?" So I think the good stories like that are the product of like organically identifying something that people, they're looking to put a word or some kind of identification to something that is a pretty universal feeling. But mostly, I think for something like when I interview people, I mean, I'm observant. I think that I'm always just trying to describe what it feels like to be in the presence of someone rather than try to do some kind of armchair analysis of them, which is why there's some of me in Glossy because the easiest way to talk about what Emily Weiss is like without being friends with her, without traveling with her extensively or something like that. And, I certainly interviewed a lot of people, but was to talk about what our dynamic was like over the years and what it felt like for me to be around her. And I think that is the secret to a lot of things.
For sure. And you've said, I don't usually hold back in terms of asking things. So when you're like in front of your subject, and I know you're not looking to make friends, right? They are your subject. Has there ever been a time when you're like, okay, I'm going to ask this, but like I'm super scared right now? Or are you just like guns blazing, like I am doing my job, you are my subject, we are not friends, and I'm going to ask you whatever I need to ask you to get the story?
No, there are definitely things that I've had to ask. I was interviewing Alison Brie, the actress, once for a publication, and it was kind of shortly after some allegations about James Franco, her brother-in-law, had been made. And I think she had, had a statement here and there, mostly said nothing. And I personally didn't think she was going to really say anything more on the subject. But my editor said, you have to ask. And I wasn't looking forward to that because It's complicated. This person is your brother-in-law. They're not you, having to comment on things that are legal. It's not something that I took delight in asking. And and it was uncomfortable. But also, that's the thing. Like, it's also just my job. And so I'll ask and I'll try to do it in a way. I think that people can really smell fear. When people get awkward and scared, you can kind of feel it on them. And I think the one thing I try to bring is not necessarily an aggressive energy, but just a lack of fear and a directness and just a calmness. My approach is not like cross-examination.
Amazing. Switching gears for a second, you've written a lot about, body image and self-acceptance, and obviously Instagram and Glossier and perfection and all the things in beauty in particular, fashion as well, of course. Do you think we're still in that place today, like post-pandemic, where it's as heavily about that, the idea of like women being perfect and a certain size, do you think we're still there or do you think we've moved past that?
I wish I could say that I felt we had moved past it and that, things had gotten better. I think it's always a little bit of one step forward, two steps back kind of thing. Certainly, one of the reasons why I was interested in writing about beauty is because I do think what we aesthetically as a culture think of as beautiful has expanded. You certainly see different kinds of faces and bodies and gender expressions and looks just in ad campaigns than, say, when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s. And that's exciting. And you have things like acne acceptance and, the idea that you're not just putting on the heaviest pancake makeup you can to cover up like freckles like I did or acne or whatever else. But at the same time, those are nice, but those people are still beautiful. They're still professional models. These brands are still trying to sell you things based on imperfections. And in terms of bodies, you have a real mainstreaming of plastic surgery and aesthetic treatments and everything that's going on with, Ozempic and many celebrities seeming to be quite thin quite quickly. That's rough even for adult, let alone someone that's growing up with it. So
Yeah, it's true.
I think it's fraught. I think it will continue to be fraught. I do think gains have been made, but I think when it comes to, beauty and body image, it's a very slow and circuitous road to progress.
Good answer. So, I mean, obviously, I've written two books. I know what it's like to launch a book. So, this book goes out into the world. It's an instant New York Times bestseller. It's optioned. Have you had a moment to enjoy what has happened to this book?
Yes and no. I have never been so kind of behind before, just in every aspect. I mean, the first few weeks, I was doing so much press and also had a book party, and my father was out visiting. And just any moment that I had to myself, I was just passing out and taking a nap and just recharging my batteries. It took a long time for me to even feel like I was catching up on email or congratulatory texts and stuff like that. All that stuff is amazing, but it also just feels like another thing that you
You have to
are kind
do.
of failing at. And I didn't want anyone to think that I wasn't grateful or happy to hear from them, but it just really what I wanted was just to be like alone on a mountaintop somewhere, just catching up on life or like not being bothered, which I actually last week went on like a hiking trip and was able to hike and, doing a tiny bit of work, but also just taking a lot of naps and drinking a lot of water for the first time in like a couple of months and, eating salads and just kind of detoxing and catching up, which was really good. I actually had dinner with my agent last night and she said, sometimes success happens and it's scary and not what you expected it. And I said, actually, I'm going to stop you there. This success has been nothing but relief and a delight. And that part has just been great. It's more just the busyness. That's exhausting, but I am absolutely just so happy that the book has been a success because you really never know.
So, is there a certain amount of time before you're like, okay, who's my next subject? Like, are you?
No, I already have my next book deal. It actually happened right before Glossy came out.
Oh my God. Oh my
It's
God.
yeah, it's on Jane Birkin. And when she died, my editor said, should that be your next book? And I thought, yeah. And so I put together an idea that's it's a biography, but it's also kind of about the creation of the myth of, the French girl and the selling of the Parisian to the world. And so I'm really excited. I'm leaving in 3 weeks or something to go to Paris for a few months to report it. So yeah, I'm off on to the next. It's very exciting.
Okay, so becoming more like Joan the Bulldog is not really in your cards, is really what it comes down to, because
Joan
you're
the
gonna be.
Bulldog is coming with me to Paris. So she's there to keep me. She's my support animal for keeping me relaxed. Also, I definitely know people in Paris, but it's a very different city and pace and life
True,
than my life in
true.
New York. And also, just by virtue of the time difference, it gives you a lot of time of peace and quiet before anyone in the US is awake and trying to get a hold of you. So it's actually a great place to get some work done and have some quiet time.
Okay, I always love when this last question, which is always the same, lands on a journalist because it's actually really funny and ironic. So, how do you ultimately want to leave your mark if you had to think of the ultimate headline for yourself? What would it be?
It's sad because I just start thinking of like obituaries.
Oh, no. Think of it like, from
I
an
just think like
achievement
Marissa
perspective.
Meltzer, like author of multiple best-selling works of women's history, dies at 93 or something.
No, 93
But
would
that's
be a
not
great
bad.
age.
Well, that's
No,
the
that's not
thing.
bad.
Like, that's pretty
No,
good.
how do you want people to think about your work, your contributions to sort of like.
I want people to think of the work as that rare breed of really smart and really fun, like that mix that we all probably want of critical acclaim and, mainstream popularity.
Love it. Marissa, thank you so much for coming on Leave Your Mark. And I'm so excited for you. And I can't wait to see the Glossy TV show because it's going to happen.
Thank you. I'm very excited.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Leave Your Mark. Leave Your Mark is a production of Leave Your Mark LLC and Money News Network. I'm your host, Aliza Licht. And if you want to learn more about how you can work with me or book my services, go to alizalicht.com. Don't forget to pick up a copy of my best-selling career advice book, Leave Your Mark, and my new book, On Brand, Shape Your Narrative, Share Your Vision, Shift Their Perception. Truly everything you need to build your personal brand or change the way people think about you. And just remember this, if change doesn't hurt a little, it's not change. Keep on rocking.